From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Hey, Fast Blast up and running now. In the last hour of the program tonight, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment. But here's what's happening. Well, guess what? That oil spill. Here we go again. BP's massive oil spill has now become the largest ever in the Gulf of Mexico. It's an ominous record that underscores the oil giant's dire need to simply stop the gusher. The oil that spewed for 2.5 months from the blown-out well a mile under the sea hit the 140.6 million gallon mark, eclipsing the record-setting 140 million gallon spill-off off of Mexico's coast from 1979 to 1980. Captain Kelly Sweeney, who monitors all these stories for us. Kelly, so it's not stopping, and here we go. It's past a record, and God knows how many more records it'll break before it's done, huh?
Yes, George. Ahoy to you and all the listeners. And it's a bad record to break, but unfortunately, it's now the largest marine oil spill in U.S. history. And but I do have a bit of good news.
What is that?
The two oil spill cleanup ships coming from the West Coast that we were concerned about because they had been caught in the hurricane made it through okay. And oil spill skimming and cleanup operations are expected to resume July 4th.
What's going on with the relief drilling?
George, I've got some inside information that I want to share with the listeners that's going to blow them away. You've been talking a lot, and it's been excellent, about the methane issue.
Yes.
One of my sources has told me that on one of the two oil rigs drilling relief wells, they've had so much methane coming back up that they closed the lower decks. They issued everybody in the crew gas masks. And you know, George, methane getting into the machinery is what caused some of the explosions on the Deepwater Horizon
and started
this whole disaster. I certainly hope they don't let it happen again.
That's scary. Okay, thanks, Kelly, for the update. More than 1.3 million laid-off workers will not get their unemployment benefits reinstated before Congress goes on its week-long break for Independence Day in the week. The hundreds of thousands more will lose their benefits in the coming weeks. The House voted now to extend the jobless benefits for people who have been laid off for long stretches, but the gesture was made futile by the Senate's inability to pass the bill. U.S. auto sales stalled in June amid fears that the fragile economic recovery continues to sputter. Eating too much sodium can push your blood pressure into the danger zone, and now researchers are reporting that eating too many sweets or drinking too much soda may have a similar effect. People who consume a high diet in fructose, a type of sugar and key ingredient in high fructose corn syrup, are more likely to have high blood pressure. They say that drinking 2.5 cans or more of non-diet soda per day or consuming an equivalent amount of fructose from other foods increases your risk of hypertension by at least 30%. Christian Wild, the author and researcher, on with us. Christian, so what does this study do to us?
Well, it makes us aware. There's been similar studies, George, in the past few years, but I think this is the most significant one to date on this particular subject. We talk about blood pressure and the silent killer, which is stroke. And hypertension is one of the major reasons that tens of thousands of people are on dialysis today. It contributes to cardiomyopathy. Certainly, fructose contributes to more than 57 million Americans, I believe, is the number who are currently pre-diabetes. It does its damage, George, because it lowers nitric oxide. And it's nitric oxide that maintains the elasticity in the arteries. So I think the big problem is that if somebody has moderately high blood pressure readings or intermediate, and then they have two or three cans of soda over 3 or 4 hours, plus whatever fructose they get from their diet other than that, and they can put themselves into a dangerous level of blood pressure.
And what does this mean, too, when you give a lot of children this stuff? Christian.
Whoa, that's why it's kind of impressive that you're seeing a lot of young people carrying water bottles. They have opted for drinking regular water or purified water as compared to spending money on these diet drinks and these sodas.
Give us an update. What's new with you?
Well, I've been really busy. The album is finished. Journey on Hold lived up to its name. We master it tomorrow, and I have one of your daughter's favorite songs on there, The Rose.
Very good.
And I'm looking forward to spending some time with you and your listeners on a longer interview in the near future.
All right, my friend. Thank you, Christian Wilde. His website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Two Maryland residents have filed a class action lawsuit already against Apple and AT&T over the iPhone 4 antenna design issue that has caused dropped calls and signal loss for some users. The plaintiffs are seeking financial compensation for their troubles, and the case also asks the court to prevent Apple from selling the iPhone 4 until the antenna issue is solved. Already, they've sold millions of these things. Federal authorities in the United States cracking down on film piracy. So they said they have forced 9 bootleg movie websites off the internet. The sites have a collection of 6.7 million visitors a month. Movie studios say they lose hundreds of millions of dollars a year to piracy. NASA's space shuttle program has gotten a brief reprieve as the space agency plans to keep shuttle flights going until next year now. The space agency made it official after weeks of hints about the potential for delays. The very last mission now, slated for Feb 26, it's a launch date. Endeavour will close out the shuttle program by delivering a major scientific instrument to the space station. Why the delays? NASA says it needs more time to prepare the cargo for those two flights. Bob Zubrin with us. Robert, tell me now if you think this means the shuttles may even go beyond that Feb 26 date, or you think that's going to be the end?
Well, there are some people trying to stretch it out. I personally don't think it's that productive. The shuttle program costs $4 billion a year, and, you know, it's doubtful whether it was worth it when we were flying 6 of them a year. It's certainly not worth it if we're flying only one a year, and it's even less worth it if we're flying none a year. So hopefully they'll just launch these 3 shuttles, get their jobs done, and retire them. But the real issue is, what do we do next?
That's right.
We've been marking time with the shuttle. Now, without a new objective, NASA will just continue to waste time without a shuttle. You know, it's like being in a taxi cab with the meter running at $10 billion a year. if as long as you're paying the fare, you might as well go somewhere. So what President Obama needs to do is commit NASA to a brave goal, which is humans to Mars, and not just in name, but make it the objective to get there this decade. That would be a productive space program.
Very good. Thanks, Robert. An Austrian university is on the hunt for girls who recoil at the sight of spiders for research into how fear affects the processes of the brain. The researchers are looking for girls aged between 8 and 13 who are very fearful of spiders and or feel sick at the sight of them. The girls will be shown pictures of the 8-legged crawlers, and their brain waves will be registered. They will also undergo free fear therapy, I guess so, they'll need it, with specialists. The researchers hope the results will help them develop their phobia treatments. A lock of hair from Napoleon Bonaparte's head after he died has been sold in the United States for $13,000 U.S. $13,000. Somebody from London bought the lock of hair. The auction actually was in New Zealand when that happened. Up next, we're going to talk about how the drug monopolies are state-supported and how they're really not concerned about the health of you. Jonathan Emord is next on Coast to Coast AM. And here's our main guest tonight, Jonathan Emord. Jonathan practices constitutional and administrative law in Washington, D.C., before federal agencies. Now, he's the only attorney in history that has defeated the Food and Drug Administration 7 times in federal court, 6 times on First Amendment grounds, author of Global Censorship of Health Information and the Rise of Tyranny. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, George.
My pleasure, too. Good work, by the way, especially Global Censorship of Health Information, which is so dear to my heart, and also the Rise of Tyranny. How did you get interested as a lawyer? How did you get interested in fighting government like this?
Well, you know, ever since I've been a small lad, I've been obsessed with studying government behavior and actions, largely because I was taken with the Constitution, with the founding period in American history. So I very much love the Constitution. I love the Declaration of Independence, and I'm pleased to no end that this country was the one that put John Locke's concepts about individual liberty into fruition in the form of a constitution that was designed to be one of liberty, to defend individual rights and to limit the power of the federal government. The sad reality, George, is that since 1938, the federal government has progressively delegated power away from the constitutional branches of the government into the hands of unelected individuals in the bureaucracy. And as I explain in The Rise of Tyranny, the real problem with our country is that we're no longer a constitutional republic. We've become a bureaucratic oligarchy. Over 90% of all federal law is not the product of our elected representatives, but is manufactured through the independent regulatory commissions by unelected leaders of these agencies. And so we have an enormous body of regulatory law that governs everything we do, and it's the product not of those we elect. As a consequence, we're no longer a republic. We've become a bureaucratic oligarchy, and this is a tragedy. It really is the undoing of the American Republic.
At what point did this start, Jonathan? I mean, you were an attorney in the Reagan administration. I don't believe you saw any of this happening then. When did it all really start?
Well, it really did start in the 1930s. 1938, what the period known as the switch in time that saved nine. The Lochner era court had struck down a number of alphabet soup agencies by Franklin Delano Roosevelt that were designed to do this very thing, transfer power from Congress to these executive agencies that would then attack the Depression and would do so unencumbered by the politics that commonly delays action by Congress. And the Supreme Court held this unconstitutional, and Schechner and Lochner, they held these actions unconstitutional because they were delegations of power outside of the constitutionally created bodies. And upset with this, Roosevelt had his attorney general create legislation that would put in place for each justice over 69 years old, there would be a new justice, which would be appointed by the president. Mm-hmm. And this would transform the court from a court in opposition to the New Deal to one stacked with New Deal advocates. In response to that, before the legislation passed, the Supreme Court did an about-face and ushered in a period of granting carte blanche to the administration the right to create these administrative agencies. As a consequence, from 38 to the present, there has been over 182 federal regulatory agencies established, and it has become popular politics in Washington to avoid controversy and delegate it to the administrative agencies to decide questions. What I'm talking about is the particular controversy that arises when action is to be taken. So, for example, a congressman or a senator will advocate clean air, and they'll support a clean air bill. But when it comes to implementing regulations that shut down plants and cause unemployment,
there's nowhere to be seen, right?
There you go.
Yeah. And you've done some work for a presidential candidate, Ron Paul, who we have had on this program before. I like the guy. I think he's decent, honest, and would try to do whatever he can for the American people. It's too bad he's not where he should be right now.
Well, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think he's one of the most honest public figures in the country, and he's a true statesman. And he's principled to the point of not deviating from his principles for a momentary compromise, even when a benefit may arise that he would recognize as a temporary benefit. If it results in a long-term disadvantage for the Constitution, he's against it. And it's that kind of principle that is almost non-existent in Washington.
And that's all we really want, Jonathan. You know, we just want these people who get elected to tell us the truth. You know, they come into office, they have all these great ideas and plans, and then most of them are never implemented, or they do totally the opposite thing they said they were going to do. At least with someone like Ron Paul, I mean, if he said go to the bank, you go to the bank.
It's definitely the case that duplicity is commonplace. It always has been a problem, of course, since the founding of the Republic for politicians to be dishonest. But what's really unfortunate today is that we have a nation of individuals who promise benefits of all kinds that carry enormous price tags. And yet then when it comes to responding to the crises that arise from these extraordinary events, they delegate away the responsibility and then point to others for blame, even though they have created the problem themselves by delegating the authority. The separation of powers in The Rise of Tyranny, in these books, The Rise of Tyranny, Global Censorship of Health Information, are available through Amazon.com, through my website, emord.com. And, oh, I should point this out. This is fantastic. 10% of the proceeds from these book sales goes to a litigation fund. You mentioned at the start of the program that we had defeated the FDA seven times in federal court. I should mention to you that FDA maintains a blanket censorship on any claim of nutrient disease association.
Now, what is that? What does that mean?
All right. If the scientific literature associates nutrients with disease. It's commonplace understanding, for example, for anyone to understand it. Say prune juice.
All right.
Prune juice reduces constipation. If you were to put that on the label of a prune juice bottle, you would be committing a felony.
Ah, okay.
You'd be prosecuted by the federal government. All right. It is prohibited with an absolute prior restraint, even though it's true.
Yet everybody knows that. That's why you take that stuff.
That's right. And, you know, omega-3 fatty acids lower the risk of sudden death heart attack. Enormous amount of evidence in the scientific literature. Vitamin D lowers the risk of breast, colon, and prostate cancer. Coenzyme Q10 lowers the risk of congestive heart failure. There are numerous dietary ingredients for which there is a massive amount of science, but it is absolutely prohibited by the FDA from getting into the market. You cannot say it, even if it's true.
And the worst part about this, Jonathan, is it's going the other way. They want to do away with these supplements.
Exactly. And so what we've done, we created this litigation fund, and the good fortune now that I have is that the proceeds, 10% of the proceeds of these books, Global Censorship of Health Information, The Rise of Tyranny, goes into this fund. It is possible, given your audience and given your commitment to these things, that we could overwhelm the agency if we had enough support to do it in these funds.
I would love to do that.
We could file petition after petition after petition on all of the nutrients for which there is science, push it through the agency, get them to, of course, deny it, sue them, and then force them through these court orders to let it out. Now, what would happen if that were to be the case would be a transformation of the American grocery store and health food store. There would be more information there to help people guide them on health choices, and suddenly, there would be a change in dietary habits in this country that would result in a significant lowering of disease and prolongation of life. Just that one claim, if we could just get omega-3s may reduce the risk of sudden death heart attack on fish and on omega-3 supplements and have that be ubiquitous, that one change could save as many as 100,000 American lives each year. That's double the number of Americans who died in the Vietnam War.
I'm beginning to think, though, Jonathan, maybe they don't want to save people. You know,
well, you're absolutely right. The FDA is in the business of protectionism, and I've practiced law before the FDA for 20 years. Anyone who has practiced law and has been intimately involved with that agency knows that that agency, and Congress condones this and supports it because it's in its financial interest to do it, that agency protects the drug industry, and it does it through numerous mechanisms. It protects the drug industry because every decision made on the approval of a drug is made by a political appointee. The political appointees frequently overrule the scientific staff. As a matter of fact, just this past January, as was reported in the New York Times accurately, FDA officials allowed improper political influence to guide their action on a medical device. The director of the Office of Device Evaluation, Dr. Donna B. Tillman, approved a medical device used for the detection of breast cancer, despite the fact that every one of the FDA experts who evaluated the product said that it did not work.
Jonathan, we're going to take this quick break and come right back with that on Coast to Coast AM. You know, I've been talking to you about my buddy who fell in St. Louis. He lives in Los Angeles, and he's been paralyzed ever since from the neck down. And it's going on 8 months now, but he is finally starting to show a little movement in his arms, hands, and his legs, just a little bit, and he's working hard at it. But he asked me last week for a gift, and how do you say no? You can't. He wants an iPad, so I picked one up, and I don't know if it was the mistake or not, but you know, this week they've been selling these iPhones like crazy at the Apple stores and every place else. Well, in I go to get my iPad, and they had one, and I just told the sales clerk, his name's Nate, I would mention his name because this young guy was absolutely incredible. He got it. He set it up. He did everything he can. So all I got to do is give it to my friend Mike and have him touchscreen it with his fingers as much as he can move them, and at least he'll start having some connection with the outside world again. So that's neat. But Nate, thanks for what you did. It was a great gesture, just helping me through that maze of new technology. I'm pretty good, but this thing is unbelievable. Okay, we'll be back in a moment with Jonathan Emode as we talk more about his work, global censorship of health information and the rise of tyranny, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Jonathan Emord, and we are talking about his legal work and what he's trying to do to protect you. So, Jonathan, do you think it's possible you can really get that kind of mandate from the FDA where they'll allow us to put things on supplements that say they really work?
Not volitionally. We have to fight for it. Yeah. It's like all precious liberties. If we don't really fight for them, we won't have them. And we've been living, you know, for our lifetimes under a regime of censorship from the FDA that keeps that information out of the market. And the tragedy is that if that information were in the market, we would be living longer. We would have less pain and suffering. People would be able to enjoy lives free of many of the ailments that afflict them earlier on in their lives. They would occur later. And they'd live longer and they'd be happier. But the tragedy is that we really do have a system that is financially controlled by the drug industry. The influence is extraordinary. The evidence in support of that is immense. In my book, The Rise of Tyranny and in Global Censorship of Health Information, I give the full history. In the case of The Rise of Tyranny, I give the full history of how the drug industry came to take over the FDA, and how once they did acquire control over the agency, how that led to the approval of numerous, over 32 unsafe drugs against the FDA's own medical reviewers' objections.
And ingredients like aspartame.
Exactly, in the food area as well, and in the medical device area.
Yeah.
And it's horrendous that an agency of the government that is commissioned purportedly for the purpose of protecting public health is more an agent of the drug industry. And this is not just me speaking. The FDA's Office of Drug Safety Associate Director, David Graham, has said the FDA, and this is a quote, FDA is inherently biased in favor of the pharmaceutical industry. It views industry as its client, whose interests it must represent in advance. It views its primary mission as approving as many drugs as it can, regardless of whether the drugs are safe or needed.
When they pull a drug, Jonathan, that has gone through its procedure, gets approved, gets on the marketplace, people die, they yank it. Why do they rush it to marketplace so fast and get FDA approval? And then why does the FDA eventually yank it? Because the public outcry is too large?
Well, it's interesting how this whole thing works because it's very mercurial, and I'll try to explain as best I can. If you're a drug company, you've invested in research to identify not that a drug will actually ameliorate a disease or cure a disease, but rather that it will affect one marker of a disease in a way that is cognizable so that it will reduce its presence. So you can, it may not affect the course of the disease at all, but that's what you've done. You've shown that it changes a marker, and that's called efficacy, or that's called the evidence of its effectiveness. And with that proof in hand, and with control over the clinical evidence, you do your own clinical evidence, natural conflict, but you do your own clinical evidence, you file your petition with the FDA. At that point, you've spent approximately $600 million. It's a game only because of the FDA's regulation that the wealthiest monopolies in the world can play. You've got now your investments in. Now, you don't have enough clinical evidence on safety for two reasons. If you did thorough safety studies, and it showed that the drug caused harm, your $600 million investment
is gone. It's gone.
So you don't do the safety evidence that you need to. And the FDA's weird system works this way. If the drug company doesn't present evidence that there's a safety problem, the FDA presumes that the drug is not unsafe. How sick is that?
Oh, my gosh. And are a lot of memos, like, tucked away and they just don't bring them out?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Let me, January of this year, or last year, I'm sorry, nine FDA scientists and physicians from the FDA Center for Devices and Radiological Health wrote to the president and to Chief of Staff John Podesta out of desperation. They're risking their careers with this. They write a letter, and it says in it, managers have been ordered, intimidated, and coerced into modifying to modify scientific evaluations, conclusions, and recommendations in violation of the law, and to accept clinical and technical data that is not scientifically valid. So you have a corrupt system where the managers, the political managers in FDA, are forcing down the throat of the scientists a politically driven decision on what to do with the drug. And the emphasis is on approval. The drug gets approved. The drug company gets it into the market. Now you'd say, hey, look, if the drug's unsafe, why would a drug company put it in the market? Here's why. It is extremely difficult to show causality in a sick person. It's extremely difficult to show that your heart attack
was caused
from Vioxx.
Exactly.
You're a sick person, you're in the hospital, you had a heart attack, could be due to any number of factors. Vioxx is one possibility, but it's only one. And the proof of causality is so hard that you can make, and Merck did, make hundreds of millions of dollars off of the drug before you take
quickly,
it off the market.
Yeah, quickly. And then they take it off and they do it again. And
absolutely.
Something else comes out. Also, if they did proper testing, wouldn't that take years?
It would.
Yeah.
It would take years. And the same FDA scientists who they get to endorse the approval of the drug, or the managers who approve the drug, those are the ones who monitor the adverse event reports. So they have a vested interest in the approval, and they have a conflict of interest because they would have to admit error to admit that the adverse event reports are legitimate.
You know what's so confusing too, Jonathan? I'm sure there are some pharmaceutical drugs out there that are very beneficial to people, that probably help people, whether it's a blood pressure pill or who knows what. Yet it gets mixed in to all of this stuff, and you just don't trust any of them.
Well, that's right. The poor physician out there is in a position where he has to accept the FDA's approval of a drug as evidence of its safety, yet knows in his heart of hearts he doesn't know whether what he's giving to his patient as the recommended drug is safe or not, other than the experience that comes. But the new drugs that are approved, the physician has no idea what's going to happen.
No, and if the salesperson is aggressive, he'll make the doctor think it's the best thing since sliced bread.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things out there is that there really are very few breakthrough drugs anymore. The pharmaceutical model is broken, and that is because we had enormous successes with antibiotics. There are many antibiotics that are fabulous. There's new ones that are horrific, like Ketek, which causes liver failure.
Oh my God!
And yeah, and there are many other recently approved drugs that cause severe medical problems. We can discuss those if you want. But one of the things that's amazing is that there are very few new breakthrough drugs. This is again David Graham. He says industry is saying that there are all these life-saving drugs that the FDA is slow to approve and people are dying in the streets because of it. The fact is that probably about two-thirds to three-quarters of the drugs that the FDA reviews are already on the market and are being reviewed for another indication. There is nothing life-saving there. There is nothing new. A very small proportion of drugs represent a new drug that hasn't been marketed before. Most of those drugs are no better than the ones that exist. Only about one or two drugs a year are truly new, and most of them aren't breakthroughs and aren't life-saving.
This Z-Pak that's been out for a while now, azithromycin, is that what it is?
Right, azithromycin.
Is that any good?
There are all sorts of problems with that. I mean, it's largely ineffectual. And it causes all of these problems, people with yeast production in their bodies and other problems because of the effectiveness of the antibiotic. But it doesn't really alleviate the symptomology that people have. This is not unusual. I mean, we've got a whole slew of drugs. We have Ketek, which I mentioned, liver failure. There's this drug for irritable bowel syndrome called Zelnorm, and it causes heart attacks and strokes.
How about this? Is it Avandia, the diabetes drug, which they're now saying is a disaster?
Oh, absolute disaster. Avandia is a perfect example of it's a diabetes drug, and that drug was for type 2 diabetes, and the consequence of it causes congestive heart failure. A meta-analysis published in New England Journal of Medicine showed an increased risk of heart attack by 43% from that drug. And it's been allowed over the objections of Robert Misben, who is the FDA chief medical reviewer, who said, don't put this thing on the market. The commissioner of the FDA overruled that person. The FDA, unlike other commissions at the agency, is a dictatorship. You know, you just have the commissioner there.
Yeah,
and the commissioner is a political appointee, and he or she is going to determine their fate based on what drugs they approve. Are they going to, when they leave the agency, are they going to be employed by the pharmaceutical industry? They're going to be employed as a lobbyist. Many of them are. And their future, really, if they were to act vigorously to protect the public and stop the admission of unsafe drugs into the market, they would have an abysmal financial future.
Heck, the FDA commissioner at the time that aspartame was approved, after he got bounced out for apparent improprieties, ended up working for the public relations company that represented the company that made aspartame.
That's exactly right. And also, that same guy was the king of the Vioxx debacle. I mean, Lester Crawford is his name.
Yeah.
He was resigned on September 23rd, 2005, after it was revealed that he had failed to disclose his financial interest in parties that are regulated by the agency, in large food companies, big drug companies. He didn't reveal his financial interest. He was given so many opportunities to reveal it. The FBI interviewed him, said, hey, look, did you make a mistake here?
Yeah, they wanted him just to say, I made a mistake. They would have been happy with that.
So arrogant that he wouldn't admit that. So then he gets out. They have to charge him. They charge him with felonies for failing to disclose, you know, false information under penalty of perjury to the federal government. And he had a good lawyer who used to work with me at Wiley, Ryan, and Fielding, who negotiated a deal with the government. He pled it, you know, copped a plea. He paid some money. And then what happens to him? This is the man who approved Vioxx into the market. Vioxx caused 140,000 heart attacks and 60,000 deaths from heart attack. The adverse event reports were pouring into the agency. The medical reviewers at the agency were bucking hard to get that drug off the market. And Lester Crawford looked them in the eye and said, no, the information's anecdotal. I don't place any faith in it. We're going to keep it on the market. And then 2 weeks before Merck withdrew it from the market, Lester Crawford unilaterally approved it for use in pediatric rheumatoid arthritis patients, in babies.
Does he have no conscience? God.
Well, I don't think so. And this is what's also such an outrage about that whole thing. I mean, he leaves the agency. He is supposedly, you know, defrocked. Here he had to leave under these circumstances. And then what happens to him? Well, he becomes hired by the public relations firm, yep, Policy Directions, Inc. in Washington, as senior counsel, and that entity represents Merck, the company that made Vioxx. So here he gets a good multi-six-figure salary instead of being held responsible for the consequences of 60,000 deaths, 140,000 heart attacks. Can you imagine that? 60,000 is roughly equal to the number of people died in the Vietnam War.
Don't they care? I mean, well, how could you not have any feelings about stuff like that?
Well, I don't know. And, you know, I'll give you an example of how callous this is. I represented an 8-year-old boy with glioblastoma, a severe brain tumor. And he was admitted into a clinical trial by Dr. Brzezinski in Texas for Dr. Brzezinski's anti-neoplastin therapy. And this boy had gone through radiation and chemo, and it was horrific. His brain would swell, and he's a little teeny guy, and he lost half of his body weight, and he would bash his head against the wall because his head hurt so badly. And his parents were just going through, you know, what every parent would, just absolutely horrific experience of trying to cope with what the doctors were telling them was a terminal disease, but they're saying you have to go through the radiation chemo. Well, they did it. They went through all the rounds. And then the doctors admitted, as they almost always do, that it's a failure, that the cancer is back, that it's going to be more aggressive, and that there's nothing we can do. So she found out about the anti-neoplastins. Well, they take him down to Texas, and the tumor starts shrinking. This is experimental, not FDA-approved drug.
Mm-hmm.
And it's shrinking. It's shrinking by a good percentage. Dr. Brzezinski gets the MRIs, sends them to the FDA because he has to, and there's a Dr. DeLapp there, who is the person who's the point man for then FDA Commissioner Andrew, what was his name? I can't remember. And this guy says to Brzezinski, you have to take him off the clinical trial. We've looked at the information, and we don't think that your drug is as effective as it's supposed to be. Furthermore, he doesn't meet the criteria. So you take this boy off, send him back to where he came from, and have him complete the radiation and chemotherapy. And his doctors on the other side with the radiation chemotherapy are saying, no, don't do that. There's nothing we can do for him. And Brzezinski's saying, this is working. And this guy, DeLapp, says, I don't care. You didn't meet the criteria and regulations. So what do we do? Well, I go protest to the government. I fight like the Dickens to try to get this boy's life saved, get him back on the anti-neoplastins. And at every turn, they're saying no. And so in desperation, I went to Dan Burton, who's then the chairman of the subcommittee on government oversight and reform. And I said, look, Congressman Burton, look at this situation. Can you help me? Is there anything we can do? And he said, absolutely. We're going to give it our best. And so he brings in the FDA commissioner, and he has me there. And he said, you go ahead and cross-examine him in my presence. I want to see him answer for these things. And so we start asking him all these questions, and he's objecting right and left, saying, I'm not going to answer these questions with a private lawyer, and this is going to reveal confidences. And he's flanked by all these bureaucrats. And Burton's saying, if you don't answer these questions, I'm going to throw you before my committee tomorrow.
And this is in a private office?
Private office.
Okay.
And so the upshot of all this is, even though, and this shows you how horrible this is, he says in his letter denying the kid the right to get the treatments, that they didn't meet the level of effectiveness that is required to justify the exception and allow the kid in the trial. Then after he meets with Burton, he calls, their office calls me and says, resubmit the information you submitted before and anything new you have. We submit the information. There's no material change in it. They reevaluate it, and suddenly they declare that it does meet the...
Oh. How about
they reversed the decision, let him in, and then this commissioner had the gall when I'm asking him questions. I asked him this question. I said, have you ever changed a decision? You said all your decisions are based on science. Have you ever changed a decision after a member of Congress asked you to? No, absolutely not. We base all our decisions on science.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
We'll be back, Jonathan, in a moment.